Our nation has been on an urbanizing blitz, especially over the last century. And according to the numbers, rural areas are being left behind. We're talking about these rural challenges on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to UN estimates, a little over half of our world's population lives in urban areas. And as we look at how the next several decades will unfold, about 70% of our world will be city dwellers. Do you worry about the economic viability of the small town you live in? Do you think the area can turn things around, or do you see the decline as permanent? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. David Swenson is an associate scientist in the economics department at Iowa State University, and his recent piece for the website The Conversation is called "Most of America's Rural Areas Are Doomed to Decline." David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're a researcher who has studied rural economies for decades now. Doomed is a really harsh word, David. What are you seeing here? What led you to this conclusion?
Well, this isn't a recent conclusion. We've been studying this for a very, very long time, not just me for the last three decades, but for the last century. Many of the counties in the Midwest saw their peak populations in the early 1900s. And in the case of, for example, Iowa, three-quarters of its counties' population peaks occurred in 1940. So rural decline is a fact of life in most of the Midwest and large parts of the United States. Now, that rural decline has always occurred because, well, basically, urban areas are growing faster. Urban areas are more attractive to people for jobs and opportunity. That's why they're urban areas, and by definition, rural areas have fewer people. And so we've always had that flow. But in recent decades, and I say at least the last 15 years, if not going back to the farm crisis of the mid-1980s, but especially in the last 15 years, this depopulation of much of our rural space has become acute. It has started to affect the other industries that still remain there. They're not able to find workers. It's starting to affect the social fabric more so than it had in the past for many of the communities, in that they're struggling to maintain their community governments and essential infrastructure and those community networks that are important for a well-functioning community. And so what I say when I say doomed, it's maybe the word is simply destined. And that's really what we're living with and trying to acknowledge reality.
David, let's look at more recent history. Mm-hmm. How were rural communities, small towns, impacted by the Great Recession?
Yeah. One of the things I do in this piece is I distinguish between metropolitan places, those with a central city of 50,000 or more, micropolitan places, those mid-sized cities that are from 10,000 but not 50,000, and then everybody else, every other county that doesn't have a city of 10,000 or more. So I have these three levels. Since the Great Recession, remember, I'm measuring just before the recession and after the recession. I want to know how have we weathered all of this and what's happened. Since that time, nearly 99% of net population gain and net employment gain has accumulated to the metropolitan counties. The remaining 1% has been split among the rest of those micropolitan counties and those rural counties in the United States. So that right there just tells an incredibly stark story of where economic and demographic advantage is accumulating in the United States and where it is not accumulating. The other thing that I was able to show in this short piece was that we have regions of the United States that are disproportionately disadvantaged. Most of those gains in people and population are accumulating to the South and to the West. The greatest stress or losses were accumulating to the Northeast, to include New England, and we in the Midwest are not very far behind New England in terms of slow performance. And so we're really being hit hard here in the Midwest in terms of our rural areas not recovering, continuous depopulation of much of our rural space. There are differences across the states. Your state, Wisconsin, doesn't look as bad as Illinois, for example, or Iowa, for example. And so there's lots of variation. But a simple fact remains that disproportionate gains are accumulating to urban areas, and disproportionate losses are being realized in our rural places.
And we're talking about this rural-urban divide with David Swenson. He's an associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What has your small town done to try to increase its viability as more and more people move to cities, urban areas? What could policymakers do to best support you and your community, a resident of a rural area? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. David, let's look at the correlation between job growth and population growth. It seems sort of obvious that when there are more jobs, there would be more people. But how closely is that linked?
Well, it is a pretty strong link. There's the degree to which jobs are able to support people varies by level of urbanization. You add jobs in a more urban area, you tend to be able to support more people. Jobs added in more rural areas, we still add jobs in rural areas. Many areas tend to show increases in employment, but decreases in population. And it gets to be a little bit complicated. But overall, yes, there's a good, strong, positive, predictable relationship between job growth and population stability. That in and of itself is the core to rural stability. But job growth isn't enough, because it's the mix of job growth that also matters. What created the prosperity of many of our rural areas was the twin engines historically of manufacturing and agriculture, or it might have been forestry or mining, but some sort of combination of resource exploitation or use, as well as manufacturing. And both of those were industries over time, both of those dimensions require fewer and fewer workers to produce more and more output because of technology. And so we never had anything to replace that out in rural areas, those original industries. And so as a consequence, our communities, which were built at a time for larger places, don't have the workforce and the workforce demand that they used to have, and therefore they struggle to maintain their physical space. They suffer from blight. They suffer from absence of an investment. And so, you know, job growth in and of itself isn't enough. We need job growth. We need good job growth. But the fact of the matter is, most of the places aren't going to get the kind of job growth that's going to retain their populations.
And it sounds like, too, automation has had an impact as well, as companies are able to do more things robotically.
Well, that's true, but automation has always been an issue, over especially since post-World War II. Rapid automation and rapid mechanization and rapid application, for example, of chemical fertilizers as fertilizers and other kinds of input changes into agriculture, all of those things decrease the demand for labor, and that excess labor has to go someplace else. It goes to urban areas.
We're talking with Iowa State economist David Swenson. He's looked closely at the numbers between rural and urban areas. He stays with us. Do you live in a rural area of Wisconsin? What have you seen in terms of job opportunities and population change? Are people moving in, moving out? What jobs are available? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We've heard about how small towns around Wisconsin, across the nation, have worked to support themselves as rural populations continue to decline, while a big share of state government money is directed at larger cities where the population centers are growing. So we're looking at where this leaves our rural communities. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What has your small town done to try to increase its viability as more and more people move to urban areas? What could policymakers do to best support you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. David Swenson stays with us. He's an associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State. Let's go to the phones now with Chris joining us from Adams. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I live in one of the most impoverished counties in the state of Wisconsin, and I live in the only virtual city that's in the county, which is between 3,000 and 4,000 people. I'm a refugee from a big city. Graciously, I'm absolutely happy about that. There are a couple of things that have happened here. The first is that we're losing our only, quote, big box store, and that Shopko is closing. And the major impact for this small town in that is that we're losing our pharmacy. And so for elderly people and disabled people who don't have transportation, that becomes a very real issue, whether or not somebody's going to pick that up and open a small, you know, pharmacy is whether or not that happens or somebody takes over the space. But we have a somewhat thriving downtown. And the reason for that is that people frequent these small businesses because they really, really are customer friendly and they take care of us. And the other thing I wanted to say is that there's a lot of stuff. I'm an arts person and there's no culture here. And there's a lot of stuff out here I can't get, but it's very friendly and it's very safe and it's very quiet. And I can have almost anything I need delivered to my door in 24, 48 hours if I really want to have it.
Chris.
Because there's a lot of stuff I can't get. And I can go on the Internet. Let me just make this point.
Yeah.
I can go on the Internet and get a lot of that intellectual stimulation that I need. So there's all kinds of electronic stuff that has happened that people do not have to live in a big city anymore if they really don't want to.
Chris, you make such interesting points that, David, you can start to pick apart here. First being that the big box store Shopko closed and access to having your medications is not close by.
Well, that's one of the more common things that have happened. You end up getting retail trade and service activity starts to shift over to whatever the next largest cities there are. We call them regional trade centers. They might be from 5,000 up to 10,000 or more. And so you get this continuous accumulation of retail trade and service activity concentrated in these areas at the expense of the surrounding communities. That's just a fact of life. That's been going on forever. But it's, again, it's more acute. And we've seen this just recently with this Shopko closing, because Shopko was one of those, it really isn't a big box store. It's kind of a medium box store. And it had a lot of diverse products in the Shopko, but it wasn't like a Walmart. It wasn't like a Target. It was the next level down for a lot of these places, and they were very, very important commercial anchors. She makes the point that she can get anything delivered to her from anywhere, you know, online. Well, that in and of itself, though, is also undermining rural retail trade and rural commercial viability. We all do this. That's not a criticism, but it's just one of those facts of life that maybe impacts rural areas even more because their commercial operators, their retail outlets, often operate on much thinner margins and are much more vulnerable to competition, not just spatially, but also over the Internet.
Well, David, tell me this. If you see a small town which has, from the look of it, a vibrant downtown where there's occupancy, there are people walking in and out of shops. Is that an indication that a smaller community is doing okay, is doing well, or can there still be all of this going on in the background of population decline and some serious issues?
Well, it's a combination of things. If people have a lot of loyalty and local identity, and that varies a lot between communities, among the communities, but if they have a lot of local identity and a local loyalty and they have a tendency to shop locally, you do see that kind of commercial vibrancy in many of our small communities. We see other communities that look like similar structurally, but their own commercial activity isn't so vibrant. So there's a lot of ranges. We talk here at Iowa State University, and we partnered with other people on this, that it's because you're declining doesn't mean you're dying. It just simply means that you're adjusting to conditions in your region. And that doesn't mean that it's all doom and gloom, as what maybe it was represented by the title of my piece, but that you can still be great places to live. They call it shrink smart. And that you focus on maintaining both those economic and social and other amenities that matter to your population, that you spend more time making sure you're taking care of your place and the people in your place, as opposed to being externally distracted from either trying to attract new employment or adopting some kind of gimmick, whatever it might be, in the hopes of somehow hitting a home run and getting a factory or whatever it might be that are going to totally change your fortunes. We're offering, and what we're suggesting is you take a very, very realistic approach to what's going on in your communities and then start working with the talent and the assets that you have.
So for policymakers to seriously consider thinking shrinking smart, if you will, mm-hmm. how would an understanding of the fact that these communities are shrinking, how can that help policymakers understand what to do next?
Yeah, it's very, very complicated. I end that article with the very potent assertion is that we don't know what to do about it. We really don't know what to do about it. And so that makes it hard for us to make recommendations. Here's what we know. We know that, for example, smokestack chasing, manufacturing, over time, over the long run, we're going to have fewer manufacturers than more manufacturers. And over time and over the long run, we're going to have fewer employment in those kinds of areas. And so the whole idea of chasing jobs oftentimes becomes problematic, and trying to recreate what we used to be is nearly impossible. So trying to figure out what we're going to be is also nearly impossible. What we believe, and what we here at Iowa State are the people that work with me, we believe that we should be doing a lot more to stabilize what we call regional trade centers. These regional trade centers ranging in size from in Iowa about 4,000 or 5,000 up to about the largest is about 29,000. And that we invest resources in stabilizing those communities, nearly all of which are contracting, stabilizing those communities, investing in necessary infrastructure, making sure that we have educational opportunities through our community colleges, helping them if we can develop leadership, but recognizing that those regional trade centers are the employment hubs now in modern society for that larger region, and that the healthier these regional trade centers are, the more sustainable and durable some of the surrounding communities can be, because they no longer can compete with these larger communities for jobs, for people. And what we really want to do is try to stabilize these regions around these trade centers. That's what I believe. Also, I believe that we need to start investing more resources in making sure that the disadvantages of rural life, whether it's isolation or transportation or access to health care, and now we're talking about broadband, that the disadvantages of rural life are mitigated to the degrees possible. That means that we cross-subsidize and we pay attention to the needs and stop defining rural problems in terms of either farmer incomes or absence of jobs, and start paying attention to what are the tangible needs of people out in rural area. And state and federal policy ought to be developed to address those tangible needs.
David, before we have to let you go, I do want to ask you about the fact that we're coming up on a presidential election. We're going to see candidates all across Iowa and all across rural areas devoting a lot of attention to swaying rural voters. While the economic power of these areas might you know, be trending downward. Is there political sway in rural communities?
There is. Right now, the political sway in rural communities is disproportionately affected by Iowa farmers. And that's one of the problems we've had, I think, with regard to policy development over the years, is politicians will come to Iowa first in the nation, the caucuses, and then they have to express some sort of fealty towards rural interest as expressed through primarily farm interest, whether it's a promotion of ethanol, which was last decade or more, or now because of the depressed farm incomes, we have a variety of proposals that are designed to promote farm employment or farm profitability. So we do get disproportionate. Rural gets disproportionate, but only insofar as it affects primarily farming. Mm. If I ranked all of the major industries, employment in major industries in non-metropolitan the United States, farming ranks eighth nationally. Manufacturing ranks second, and government ranks number one. So the politicians miss the boat a lot of times by just trying to sell to farmers.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for asking.
David Swenson is an associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State, and his recent piece for The Conversation is called "Most of America's Rural Areas Are Doomed to Decline." Coming up, light trespass is the poor control of outdoor lighting that crosses property lines. We'll learn more about it after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about light trespass here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Streetlights, car lights, home and garden lights, illuminated billboards, all are prone to giving off this unwanted light that's not shining in the right direction or at the right intensity. And a study in the journal Science Advances found that basically all Americans live with light pollution. 4 out of 5 people on Earth live with the problem of artificial light taking over the darkness. Have you had to deal with a neighbor's light encroaching on your property? What did you do about the situation? Do you think streetlights or other outdoor lighting is too bright, or do you appreciate bright outdoor lights? Join in at 800-642-1234. Don Sanford is an outdoor lighting consultant. He worked at Wisconsin Public Television for 30 years, where he was a volunteer manager and production manager working on lighting and location. Don, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you today?
Doing well. So help us understand, what is light trespass?
Light trespass is when light that is intended for lighting one area spills over and goes someplace else that it's not intended to go.
All right. So if you have a street light right outside your bedroom window, speaking from experience in my past house, shining right into your infant's bedroom, there's an issue there. That is light trespass.
That's right. And it's an unintended consequence, I guess, is the best way to describe it. And it's very much akin to going into your living room and just taking all the lampshades off. The light isn't any brighter. It's just going the wrong way. Instead of being focused down, it's now going helter-skelter.
How does light trespass contribute to overall light pollution?
That's where light pollution comes from. Because instead of having light focused at a subject, at a parking lot, at a front porch, at an architectural feature, planting on the outside of your house. Instead of being focused at that, it's instead let go to release to travel straight up. And that's what people typically think of as light pollution, is that light is going up into the sky. And, you know, the Martians already know we're here. We don't have to send them signals. You know, they already know we're here. So So it's just wasteful. It's just plain waste. It's annoying, and it's wasteful to send light up into the sky.
Don, do you think light trespass is worse than it used to be? Is it getting better, worse, stabilizing?
I'd say it's stabilizing. I think people are more aware of the problem, and I think manufacturers are starting to market fixtures that control this light trespass. And one of the things there are two things that I think are important here. It's not the brightness. It doesn't matter. You can put a lower light bulb in a bad fixture, and it's still going to be bad. And it's not the source. You can think you're doing a great thing for the environment by buying an LED fixture, throwing out your old incandescent fixtures, and buying an LED fixture. If the fixture is improperly designed, it's still bad. You know, you're still not doing anybody any favors. You're just spending less money, and still doing something bad.
So you really not only have to think about illumination and about what kind of light you put in and screw in, but you really have to think about the actual fixture itself.
That's right. Because if you can see, one of the ways to know if you're creating light pollution or light trespass is walk across the street, walk over into your neighbor's yard, or if you live on a lake, go half a mile out into the lake and look at your house. And if you can see the light source or the source of the light, not the effect of the light, which is, you know, the light hitting the ground, but if you can actually see the light, then you've got light trespass. You're a trespasser.
We're talking about the impact of what is called trespass light. Don Sanford is an outdoor lighting consultant. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you taken steps to make sure your outdoor lighting isn't bothering your neighbors or perhaps bothering wildlife? What tips do you have to make sure your lighting isn't too bright? What questions do you have about how to make sure you're not contributing to light trespass or light pollution? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Joe now, joining us from Neenah. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I absolutely agree with the point being raised here. I live on a lake, and I live in the city, and there are people who buy sodium vapor lights who think they have to be eternally secure. They're afraid of anything coming on their property. But what they fail to realize is that there are side shields. There are devices that direct light downward on your property, and all you'll see on the lake is the glow of someone's property, but it will not spill into the sky. I suggest they go to the website of the IDA, International Dark Sky Association, and they'll learn what kind of devices can be purchased. But I do not appreciate a neighbor who puts in LED lighting and fails to put in side shields. Right now in the city, I do have neighbors like that. And you just see such a bright light, and there's no need for it. You can light your property with the proper lighting fixture, as was pointed out.
Joe, thanks so much for the call. Don, what about side shields? What do
they
do?
They are most commercial fixtures come with side shields as an option. For whatever reason, the most common fixture that are put up on commercial buildings are things called wall packs. And that's a fixture that is attached to the outside of a building. It looks like a glass box. And the proper wall packs have a metal cover that come right down to the bottom of that fixture so that the light is forced to go straight down. But that's an option, and a lot of times the installer or the architect, whoever specified that fixture, misses that option, and you create a light bomb instead of a beautiful lighting on the outside of a building. The other place where you often see these issues is we call them bollard lights. They're these posts that are maybe about waist high, and they have a opening at the top with sometimes some louvers. But the louvers are not always installed, or they're installed improperly. Instead of the light being forced down onto the pathway, it it goes out horizontally, and those things are conveniently, I say sort of a, with a wink, wink, they're at a convenient height. So if you're a you're in your car and you're driving by, they're exactly at eye level for a driver, and you drive by one of these poorly installed fixtures, and bang, you get hit right in the eye, and when you get a bright light shining into your eyes like that, you're temporarily blinded. Very hard to see.
Let's go to Jenny now, joining us from Germantown. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind about light trespass?
I have a neighbor who has a security light that goes on and off with motion detection outside my bedroom window. If a rabbit runs across the street a mile down the road, that light goes on, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
I counted 43 times one night before I got so frustrated that I just stopped counting. It wakes me up all night long, and I do not want to have to resort to light-blocking shades because I like to wake up to the sun in the morning. So is there any legal recourse for me with this?
Don, what are regulations that, what are the, you know, are there regulations to for light pollution?
Yeah, in most municipalities, there are regulations about light trespass. And, but they're, sometimes they're hard to find. Talking to a neighbor who has bad light, a bad light is like telling somebody that they've got bad breath. It's one of the most uncomfortable things you can do. And so you turn to a building inspector because, you know, that's what these people do. And I looked at several lighting codes. I mean, here in Madison, our the ordinances about light trespass are tucked into the zoning code. And the way you can find those sometimes is if you just go to your municipality's website and find the code of ordinances and do a search in there under lighting, and it'll be tucked in there. And there are measurements. The way that this is determined is that an inspector will come out with a special light meter and will stand at the property line, and there are measurements, foot candle measurements, that will indicate how much light can come across the property line. And usually it's in the order of one or maybe three foot candles, which isn't a lot. Or sometimes the ordinance will be written to say that you shouldn't be able to see the source or its reflection from the other side of the property line.
So you're saying that they'll actually take measurements to see exactly how much light is spilling over?
Right. There are measurements, and there are building codes, just like there are codes for everything else about sidewalks and the construction of a building and the way the parking lot is marked. There are codes and there are ordinances that are written to detail and describe what light trespass is and how much is allowed.
Outdoor lighting consultant Don Sanford is our guide as we talk about light trespass. Have you ever been out in nature with no artificial lighting at all? What was it like for you to see the night sky in the absence of any light pollution? Did seeing a part of the world without any light pollution change your thoughts on how much outdoor lighting we need? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Our world is lit by electricity, and there are some words to describe different light pollution. There's over-illumination, light clutter, sky glow, light trespass. We're talking about light trespass here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Unwanted light creeps onto someone else's property or into another person's window, so you may have a light on your back patio illuminating your backyard. If some of that light creeps over the fence, shines into your neighbor's living room through a window, your backyard light is trespassing on your neighbor. Have you had to deal with a neighbor's lights encroaching on your property? What did you do about the situation? Do you think street lights and other outdoor lighting tends to be too bright or not powerful enough? Does outdoor lighting make you feel safe? Join in at 800-642-1234. Outdoor lighting consultant Don Sanford stays with us. Don, we had an email from Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, and he said, my city went from mercury vapor to sodium vapor to LED. And he said, I'm glad we are back to blue from the orange of sodium vapor. Each change resulted in reduced electricity use. Can you help us understand which of these, what's going on here with these different types of light?
Well, the LED light, of course, is the most modern advanced light source and uses far less electricity than anything else that was been there before. And using less electricity is one thing, but it's all about the fixture design. And because an LED fixture is designed to put out the same amount of the same number of lumens, the same brightness as a sodium fixture or a mercury vapor, they're designed to put out that same level, deliver the same amount of light onto the street, for instance. But it's in the fixture design.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so critical. I've been in towns where they remodeled their downtown lighting and put in these wonderful fixtures that used I think they were sodium vapor, I can't think what the source was, but anyway, it was an improvement for them, but the fixtures are so poorly designed that they created all this glare, and the glare is the term when light shines in your eyes or in your bedroom or goes someplace or it goes up, it's where it's not supposed to go, that's glare, and that it doesn't matter what the light source is, glare is bad. And the thing is that you know this intuitively when you're walking down the street or driving down the road. You know it when a light shines in your eye, holy cow, look at that light just shined right. That's glare, and that's not good lighting.
Let's go to Doug now, joining us from Loganville. Hi, Doug.
Hi there. I just want to make a comment. When I was much younger, growing up on the farm, so I'm one of a really, really big hill in Sauk County, and if you went out on a clear night, you could see the stars like you'd never seen before, and it was amazing, so much so when I got a little bit older and got married, I took my wife out to the same spot on a nice clear night to show her the stars. But, there's a glow from the towns all around in every direction. You can just count Reedsburg or Loganville or those had gotten much brighter over time.
Doug, thanks so much for the call. And it's, you know, Doug can reach back to his childhood and remember much darker skies. Mm-hmm. Is it light trespass to blame?
Yes, definitely. And another way to think about this is the next time you're flying, you know, you jump in an airplane, you fly across the country, and you fly over a city at night sometime, and you look out the window, and a light is shining up at you. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Why is somebody paying good money to send a light 10,000 feet up in the air?
Right,
you know,
yeah.
And that light contributes to sky glow because that the light source, it's uncontrolled, goes up and reflects off the moisture in the air, and that's what creates this sky glow that we see.
You're out on the lakes a lot. What does it look like from your vantage point from, say, Lake Monona or Mendota as you look back to shore?
I took someone out on a boat ride one night trying to explain light trespass to them, and it was a hard sell. Didn't quite get it until we were coming up to her dock, and she lived in an area up on the north side of Lake Mendota where it's pretty dark. And her husband heard us coming in the motorboat and flipped on the yard lights. And instantly, we were blinded. I mean, by then, we'd been out in the lake for maybe an hour, and our eyes had gotten used to this darkness. And he, thinking he was doing a good turn, turned on the lights on the outside of the house. Boom. All of a sudden, we were bathed in light. It was we were like deer in headlights. And she looks at me and says, I understand now.
You have this background in theater, TV lighting. How did the issue of light pollution come to your attention, and why did you decide to pursue this?
Well, in theatrical and television lighting, if you want to see something, if you want the audience or the viewers to see something in a scene, you point a light at it. And if you don't want them to see something, you trim the light off so it's only lighting that. And in a theater, we're trying to send light from a lighting fixture that's 20 feet away down onto the stage or onto the set. And so controlling the direction of light is critical in that line of work. And a friend of mine, David Liebel from UW Extension at the time, was working on a project, and somehow we got together. I can't remember, but he said, I'm trying to understand this. And so we connected, and it was I discovered that at that time that outdoor lighting is just like all the other work that I have been doing during my career, except it was a whole new stage, a whole new venue.
So if you're feeling like you're a trespasser, is it possible to modify the lighting you already have instead of buying new fixtures or new lights?
Yes. Yeah. It's in some cases it's easy. Sometimes, you know, I've helped people modify existing fixtures with sometimes we've used a little bit of aluminum, especially the aluminum roof flashing works well. I mean, you want to turn the fixture off. And, you know, you want to be careful. You don't want to start running screws into a light fixture that might be energized. But you can add shading to it. You can't really paint out the lens on fixtures. Paint on glass just doesn't work very well. And sometimes it's just a matter. We retrofitted a parking ramp. We helped the owner retrofit a parking lamp that was creating incredible light trespass onto Lake Wingra. And all it required, I mean, there were maybe 25 light fixtures in this parking ramp, 30. And all it required was two guys, a stepladder, and a couple of wrenches. And they just adjusted these fixtures. And in the matter of an afternoon, the problem was solved. It was just... So sometimes the solutions to this are really simple and don't require a huge capital outlay to make everything better.
Don, as we wrap up here, what would you tell city leaders as they look to replace street lights, street lamps, and how they're installed in neighborhoods?
You want to make sure that all the fixtures that you install are full cutoff, and their descriptions of, if you just Googled full cutoff lighting, or another booklet that was published by Extension called Sensible Shoreland Lighting. If you Google either one of those subjects or you visit the International Dark Sky Association's website, you'll find model ordinances, you'll find samples, drawings, photographs of good lights and bad lights, full cutoff fixtures, and that will really help you as a person struggling with this. It'll help you understand that you're not alone, that this really is a problem. It's just not, and there is a solution.
Don, thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me, Kate.
Don Sanford is an outdoor lighting consultant, worked at WPT for 30 years, where he was a volunteer manager, production manager, working on lighting and location. Coming up, it's news that a Dane County family recently won a multimillion-dollar settlement from the state's Medical Malpractice Insurance Fund. We'll discuss the case and the law that limits medical malpractice awards here in Wisconsin. Stay with us. News is next on the Ideas Network.